I will begin by outlining the development of the color problem in the modern discourse, aiming to show the enduring resistance of the notion of color as an intrinsic property of the objects, notwithstanding the scientific explanation of color as a subjective impression caused by a certain degree of refraction of light on the surface of the objects. Then I will focus on how a few pre-Socratic authors were able to exploit that notion that to them was obvious in terms and ways well worthy of attention. So, for introducing the topic, I just say that we all live in a colorful world. Color is an essential feature of things as we perceive them with our most precious sense, vision, and thus it is fundamental to orient ourselves in the outside world. But is color as important to the physical account of it, of the world? Already in antiquity, a number of philosophers questioned this point within the wider debate on the reliability of sense perception. A well-known peak of this discussion is Anaximander's fifth mode, in which he claims that phenomena such as the changing colors in a moving pigeon's neck, or the oar appearing bent in the water, and the square tower appearing round from a distance, leave the observer with no rational ground for ascribing to the object a color or a shape rather than another. But this problem, which was nosological, attained an ontological dimension and thus became crucial to modern philosophy and science in connection with the distinction of primary and secondary qualities prompted by the so-called scientific revolution and strictly related to the rise of mechanist theories, theories aspiring to replace the Aristotelian allomorphic account of the material substances to a new paradigm centered on matter and motion. As Galileo Galilei, the father of the distinction of primary and secondary qualities, put it in a famous passage of Il Saggiatore, any corporeal substance cannot be conceived, and thus cannot exist, independently from such properties as shape, size, motion, rest, and position. On the contrary, let us see what he says about sensible properties in text 1, just the words I underline. I think, I read the English translation, because also ancient Italian is difficult also to us. I think that tests, odors, colors, and so on are no more than mere names, so far as the object in which we place them is concerned, and that they reside only in the consciousness. This is a translation of Italian corpo sensitivo. Of course, the correct, most correct translation is perceiving body. So they reside, sensible qualities reside only in a perceiving body. Hence, if the living creature were removed, all these qualities will be wiped away and annihilated. Throughout the 17th and 18th centuries, there was about the status of sensible qualities a lively and variegated debate that involved Galileo, Gassendi and Descartes, as well as Locke, Boyle, Hume and several others. While I cannot summarize this debate here, I must at least dwell for a moment on the discovery that has made color the most intriguing among the sensible qualities to philosophers and scientists alike. I am, of course, referring to the claims advanced by Isaac Newton in his New Theory about Light and Colors. This work stemmed from a long history of experiments on the decomposition of light through the triangular prism. It contained the demonstration that a variety of colors can be reduced into a range of hues, hereafter called spectrum, hues precisely ordered according to the different degrees of inclination of the light passing through media of different density. It is the so-called refrangibility. Thereby, color was proved by Newton to be a quality that the subject of the vision associates to the particular wavelength of light transmitted from the illuminated body to hit his or her sensory apparatus. This finding has had the major impact on the problem of color, as the color was shown not only to depend on the presence, location, and physical conditions of the beholder, but even to be equivalent to a certain angle of refraction of the external light, determined by such a primary feature as the texture, such a primary feature as the texture of the body. In other words, after Newton, even with no light, no color. In the long run, however, the new scientific explanation of the chromatic phenomenon has caused a gap between scientists and philosophers. Whereas scientists have preferred to consider color as a merely subjective experience, the philosophers have always been unwilling to disclaim the inherence of colors to the physical objects, owing to the unquestionable causal role colors play in a variety of experiential fields, epistemological field as well as aesthetic, emotional, symbolic. I cannot summarize here this story either. Yet, let me remind you, fast forwarding to the present day, that in the last few decades, an entire philosophy of color has flourished, whose main aim is still to explain how the sensation of color arises from colorless matter. In fact, the issue of filling the gap between rays of reflected light and chromatic sensation is the most crucial test for the problem of reconciling the scientific image of the world with a manifest one. I'm using, of course, the terms of Wilfrid Sellars. And indeed, it has even been said that a color body problem is the hard problem of today's philosophy of mind, compared to which the mind-body problem disappears. This introduction, as anticipated, is aimed to show that contemporary philosophy of color, in its concern to save the chromatic phenomenon, is brought to find much food for thought in the ancient theories. The reason for this is the fact that these theories shared, with few exceptions, a pre-theoretical notion of color as an inherent property of the object. This feature has already been the object of classical scholarship, but in this occasion I would like to take the chance to move into the foreground the concept that is in the very title of our conference, namely the concept of power. I will argue, in examining a number of texts from the pre-Socratic age to Aristotle, that the conception of color as an essential feature of things is one with the idea of that color, compared to other sensible qualities, as a unique power of impressing the sense of vision, thanks to its particular relation with light. In fact, one might put it in this way: whereas, according to the Newtonian paradigm, color is a quality of external light, in the common Greek experience on which philosophers build their theories, light is, conversely, a quality of colors, as colors are determined by the amount of light that is present in the body itself or on its surface. That is why the first section of my speech, I gave the title The Power of Brightness. And I would like to start by recalling that the Greek language shows a remarkable predilection for notations of brightness and for the emotional resonance of colors. One can think, for instance, to a word like xanthos, which qualifies the hair with a resonance of warm reflections, or think also of the alarming light of the eye when it is Glaucos, in Glaucopis Athena, of course. Moreover, Greek color terms present a puzzling semantic fluidity, so much so that there apparently is no word, for example, corresponding to our blue. Glaucos, the term glaucos, indeed describes a light blue trespassing into gray, whereas the term cyanus describes a shade closer to black. And, rather startlingly, sky is never described as blue. Such peculiar features of Greek color vocabulary are explained today with the observation that the Greeks used to privilege in their experience of colors one, just one, of the three aspects that define any chromatic sensation according to the Munsell colorimetric system. I think it may be helpful to pass this image, a possible drawing of this colorimetric system, which was created at the end of the 19th century by Albert Henry Munsell, and anyway, it is still most widely used nowadays. The three dimensions for defining colors today are mostly the hue, which is determined by the position in the Newtonian spectrum, by which we discriminate one color from another, then the value, or lightness, ranging from bright to black on the vertical axis that you see in your image. The chroma, the third dimension is the chroma, which corresponds to the purity or saturation of the color. It is crucial that Greeks experienced colors in degrees of lightness and darkness rather than in terms of hue, of precise discrimination of hues. Now, I suggest adding to this picture the concept of saliency, namely the capacity of a color to catch visual attention. Saliency is connected, among other things, position of the colored object, contrast between colors, etc. Saliency is connected, depends from the capacity of an object, I repeat, to catch visual attention depends from its brightness, which is the psychological notion corresponding to the colorimetric one of lightness. So more clear is a color, more bright is a color, the more is salient, the more it catches visual attention. And that concept is more or less explicitly assumed in description, literary description, or philosophical reflection on colors. This concept of saliency is not only relevant to the general issue of Greek chromatic vocabulary, but it is also important to the understanding of the Greek theories I am going to examine, as these theories leverage precisely the saliency of color, namely its power to attract visual attention. It is notable to start that one can find this emphasis on brightness of color in the first text of Greek literature in which this notion draws philosophical attention. It is text 2 in the handout, the fragment 8 of Parmenides, where you can read that changing place and altering in bright color, chroa phanon, are among the characteristics mortals ascribe to reality. The adjective phanon shows that there is here an emphasis on brilliance, with its power to catch the eyes. Moreover, If we think that the basic principles in Parmenides' cosmology are light and darkness, corresponding to fire and night, it is clear that color was conceived by Parmenides as an essential characteristic, Parmenides in the Docs, of course, as an essential characteristic of the bodies, whose variance depends from the proportion of the two principles entering in the constitution of sensible compounds. I skip now a short section. I have my text on Pythagoreans and also on Melissus to go to the fragment 4 of Anaxagoras, which seems to me relevant to this issue. Because, let's see how the precosmic situation is described in this fragment. It is described as a jumble of all seeds bearing all kinds of shapes, colors, and flowers. In the second line of the Greek, ideas pantoias econta kai kroias kai edonas. In this precosmic situation, no color is manifest. The following line, ude croie endelos hen udemia. And the wet and the dry, the hot and the cold, the bright and the dark are not yet separated. One can infer, e contrario, that in Anaxagoras' view, the nature of the compounds in the ordered world, determined by the preponderance of seeds of a kind rather than of another, is manifested first in their being colored, according to the prevalence of light or darkness, and lightness and darkness correspond respectively to prevalence of hot, dry, or cold, wet elements in their constitution. So it seems to me that in case we wanted to play the game of fitting ancient categories into the pigeonholes of modern philosophy of color, we would not err in ascribing to Anaxagoras a primitivist position. For primitivism assumes that colors are physical properties completely independent from the perceivers. And physically, primitivism also implies on the epistemological level that perception is all we need for knowing colors. I propose now to pursue this game further and consider a few other ancient accounts which are in fact often invoked as precedents of other modern stances on color, namely, in addition to the primitivist position, the physicalist, the eliminativist, and the dispositionalist ones. Considering first Empedocles' theory of perception, for example, we see that Empedocles explains all sensible qualities as physical properties of the bodies, corresponding to a set of capacities of affecting perceivers in a certain way. Well, in modern terms, such a theory could be characterized as physicalist, since physicalism also wants to go deeper beyond phenomena, the manifest image, if you allow me to use this definition. Physicalism goes deeper beyond phenomena in order to grasp the underlying truth, i.e., the scientific image. And, as a matter of fact, in Empedocles' view, the capacity to cause sensations is embedded in the four roots he considers to be the basic principles of the cosmos, from which all forms and colors of beings are generated. If you see text 6, fragment 71 of Empedocles, third line, all the things, sensible things are mixed, are born, forms and colors of mortal, as many as are generated by being harmonized by Aphrodite. Eide tegeloieto proiet ethleton, 9-3. Moreover, in Empedocles fragment 6, which is text 5, it is made clear in other fragments, it is made clear that fire and air share a bright material consistence, whereas water and earth are on the opposite side and belong to the area of darkness. That is why, for instance, bones are white. If you see fragment 96, text 7, here is the constitution of bones is described like that. Harmony has combined a minor amount of earth necessary for the bones to be solid and an equal amount of water, but a larger amount of fire. Fire was necessary for cooking and hardening the blend, the composition, but also gives bones their color, which is white. It is also clear that brightness is crucial to Empedocles' concept of color. As confirmed by Theophrastus in the De Sensibus, Empedocles explained the production of all colors through the mixture of two elements, fire and water, which correspond respectively to white and black. Although white is not a color anymore after Newton, one might say that white is the most salient color in the Greek experience, and that for this reason it is always present along with its opposite black in the philosophical list of the basic colors from which all other colors are generated. In longer lists, however, red maintains its right to the third position. Red is for us the most, for the modern psychology, the most salient color, of course. I conclude this survey of Empedocles' theory noting that the assumption of an objective subsistence of color is central also to Empedocles' theory of vision. Empedocles believed that clear colors are perceived thanks to a flow of matter more fiery and airy that goes to meet the fire in the eye, whereas dark flows find the appropriate way into the watery passages in the eye. It is true that Empedocles ascribes a crucial role to the ocular fire emanating from the eye, as illustrated by the famous analogy with the lantern. Yet, we can well assume that colored effluences emanate from the object with equal energy to the ocular fire. This energy, I think that this energy is a sort of heritage of how sensible properties behaved in the primitive stage of cosmos. In text 8, fragment 90 of Empedocles, we can read that in that cosmic stage, sweet grabbed sweet, bitter rushed toward bitter, sharp went to sharp, and burning was drawn to burning. Passing to Plato, one can say that Plato is just realistic as Empedocles in his treatment of colors in the Timaeus. I skip the details of Plato's account of vision. It is notable that in this account, daylight is not only a condition of vision, which makes the things visible, but it is also one with the fire coming from the beholder's eye, and thus is an essential agent in the process. However, Plato is committed to an account that combines the subjective and the objective aspects of vision. And in fact, when in the Timaeus he comes to colors, he says that colors is a flame. In a passage just a little before text 9 you have in the handout, Plato defines color as a flame flowing off from each body, having parts commensurate with visual body, the ocular body, so as to produce perception. This means that the specific color of a body is determined by the particular size of the pyramidal particles or the fire, because color is a sort of fire, a flame, emitted from the body, such that it affects the visual ray in a certain way. For instance, the sensation of leucon is caused by smaller fire particles act to dividing those that make up the visual ray and thus act to expanding the visual ray, while the sensation of melan occurs reversely when larger particles of fire, larger pyramids, thicken the smaller particles of the visual ray, which is thus extinguished. This is how sensations of white and black are explained in text 9, which begins with this word of the particles which fly off from the other bodies and strike into the visual body. Visual body is a wall of the ocular eye and daylight. Some are smaller, some larger, some are equal to the particles of the visual body itself, etc. In sum, I believe we can say that Plato thinks that color is an inherent property of the bodies, regardless of whether or how they are perceived. Color is indeed a specific kind of fire emitted from the body, which has the power to act in a certain way on the visual body and then the organ. Remember, I already said it, that a fundamental solid of fire is the tetrahedron or pyramid, whose angular configuration determines the extreme mobility and capacity of penetration of this element. So the particular power of fire allows to explain the diverse capabilities of colors to causally affect the subject according to different degrees of brightness, again. In other words, according to their diverse science. So it is not surprising that Plato's list of primary colors includes, besides white and black, red, and most remarkably, what Plato calls bright and shining, lampron kai stilbon, the bright, which is not a color at all to us. Red is produced by a kind of mid-range fire made of mid-range particles, which mix with the moisture in the eyes without turning off the visual beam. While the brilliant color arises, we could say, as from a firework on the water. The water, of course, is that that constitutes the visual organ. And it is worth reading the, how this process is described in text 10. The more rapid motion, being that of a different species of fire, which strikes upon the visual stream and dilates it as far as to the eyes, and penetrating and dissolving violently the very passages of the eyes, causes a volume of fire and water to pour from them, which he called tears. And this moving body, being itself fire, meets fire from the opposite direction, and as the one fire stream is leaping out like a flash, and the other passing in and being quenched in the moisture, in the result of mixture, colors of all kinds are produced. This affection we term dazzling, and the object which causes it bright or brilliant, a phrase on which I will return in a while. It is clear, a final comment on Plato's theory, it is clear that Plato does think that colors are really out there, so to speak, with an active power of their own, inasmuch he assumes that different, qualitatively different emanations of fire, but different for the size of the particles, cause correspondingly different chromatic sensations. To this extent, no doubt, Plato reconnects to Empedocles' realistic stance. However, I will not claim that Plato shares Empedocles' physicalism, because his construction in the Timaeus pivots exactly around reducing the Empedoclean elements to regular geometric figures. Therefore, it is unlikely that he considers the emission from the object, as having a color of its own. In any case, Plato shows to be acutely aware of what is the core of the problem, since he draws a lucid distinction between the names we use to give to colors, namely to our sensation of colors, and the physical conditions that make them possible. In text 9, note the last phrase after the description of how white and black are produced. Plato specifies that this is how one should speak of them. What divides the visual body is white, and the opposite thereof is black. And again, text 10, the last phrase, disaffection, we already read it, disaffection, pathema, we term dazzling, and the object which causes it, bright or brilliant. By qualifying the use of color terms in this way, Plato comes rather close to Democritus' conventionalist position, which I am going to describe in the following section, to which I gave the title of The Light Body Problem. While maintaining brightness as a turning point of his explanation of colors, Democritus takes us into a different territory, where the only authentic reality is constituted of individual atoms moving in the void, colorless and flowerless, deprived, in short, of all those features that characterize and identify sensible bodies. The differences sensible bodies exhibit at a macroscopic level emerge from the geometrical features of the atomic entities that constitute their structure. These features being shape and size, position, and their reciprocal arrangement in the compounds. And for instance, as Theophrastus makes clear in the section of De Sensibus devoted to Democritus' explanation of flowers, a soul test is caused by angular, small and thin atomic forms, whose effects on the tongue are different from those caused by a grid of round and large atoms, which produce instead a sweet taste. So, it is correct to say, as Aristotle does in the De Sensu, that Democritus reduces the Greek verb is anagen, reduces flowers to shapes, like he does with white and black, which he identifies respectively with smooth and rough. Aristotle is a testimony of Aristotle in the De Sensu. Democritus' very words seem to confirm that his position about sensible qualities is anti-realistic. As he famously says in Fragment 9, one of the many, by convention sweet, by convention bitter, by convention hot, by convention cold, by convention color, but in reality atoms and void, really is asleep. One finds in this fragment a frank denial of the existence of sensible qualities at the hidden level of the basic principles. According to this view, sweet and bitter, hot and cold, and color are just labels that people apply to the sensations caused in their atomic constitutions by certain atomic configurations that do not have flavors, nor temperatures, nor colors in themselves. It is to be added that for Democritus, the disposition of subjects is so relevant to the final product of the perceptive process as to spark Theophrastus' criticism that Democritus contradicts himself in making perceptive qualities mere affections of the senses. One understands then why Democritus' theory may have been interpreted as an eliminativist one, to the point that it is often mentioned by contemporary philosophers as the most ancient case for the eliminativist view of color, a view which, I quote, convicts ordinary experience of widespread error. However, a different interpretation is to be preferred. As a matter of fact, I think that the term and expression nomon in Democritus' glossological statements refers to a conventional agreement about how phenomenal entities are denoted. Moreover, Democritus does not assume that the denominations of sensible qualities are merely arbitrary constructions. Rather, he thinks that they are correct descriptions of the effects arising in normal conditions, of course, from specific atomic structures. In this reading, it should be clear, first, that Democritus' view comes close to Plato's remarks on the language of perceptions on which I drew attention above. And secondly, but just as importantly, that Democritus is not an eliminativist. For, in spite of a few complications in his theory of vision that I leave to discussion, the fact remains that the way in which the visual emanations, eidola for Democritus, affect the subject is causally determined by the molecular structure of the seen body. I have chosen as text 12, a chapter of Theophrastus De Sensibus, where the microstructure of objects that appear white and black is described in detail. Summarizing it for the moment, it is clear in this passage, from this passage, that the specific microstructure of the object determines the way in which light is reflected through and from the reticular surface of it, thus generating a certain chromatic quality that is transmitted through the visual eidolon. Furthermore, the clearer the color, the more easily the eidolon passes through the air and the more effectively it impacts on the sensorium. Let us see at least what happens with the darkest color in the last lines of text 12 in the translation, page 5, fourth line from the bottom. Black is composed of figures the very opposite to white, of course, rough, irregular, and differing from one another. For these cast shadows, and the passages amongst them are not straight nor easy to thread. Their effluences, too, correspondingly, are sluggish and confused. For the character of the effluence also makes a difference in the representation. That's how high translator Fantasia Stratton translates differently. The character of the effluence also makes a difference in the representation, as this emanation is changed by its retention of air. It's sluggish and confused. That is why the sensation is different, for example, from that of white. I think that we might count. See, 5 minutes. I'll try. I think that we might count Democritus among the dispositionalists, those who think that colors belong to objects as dispositions to affect the sense of vision in a certain way, whether or not there are conditions for the objects to be perceived. However, one has to admit that within the atomistic framework, the notion of disposition is linked to mechanical arrangement of the atomic constituents in the body rather than to an active power of the object, in the object, if you want. It is instead such an external thing as daylight that has all the active power needed for vision. From this very point, as we are going to see in concluding, Aristotle will take the greatest distance. I cannot obviously dwell here on the Aristotelian position, but suffice it to mention that Aristotle does not accept Democritus' corpuscularist option, according to which what affects the eye is a specific body, light is a body, which is distinct from the objects at the same time when it extracts colors from their texture by way of mechanic motions and geometric trajectories. Aristotle shares with precedent accounts of colors like Empedocles and Plato's realistic conception, elaborating in his terms the notion that perceptive qualities characterize the objects independently of whether perceivers are there or not. But Aristotle also innovates in giving a new definition of light, which he considers to be not a body, but a condition, hexis, of the transparent, diaphanes. It is a crucial move, that diaphanes, a new concept in itself, is a condition common to the medium and to the bodies, and the central role of diaphanes is to guarantee the continuous transmission of information by activating the medium from the objects of sight to the subject. As we read in text 13, Aristotle de Sensu, but what we call transparent is not something peculiar to air or water or any other of the bodies usually called transparent, but is a common nature and power, dynamis, capable of no separate existence of its own, but residing in this and subsisting likewise in all other bodies in greater or less degree. As the bodies in which it subsists must have some extreme bounding surface, so too must this. Here, then, we may say that light is a nature inhering in the transparent, when the latter is without determinate boundary. But it is manifest that, when the transparent is in determinate, limited bodies, its bounding extreme must be something real, and that color is just this something we are plainly taught by Fichte. I am concluding, for real, that whereas Democritus had disconnected light from the physical bodies, as it were, Aristotle returns light to them, thus giving back to nature that power, that is energy and life, of which nature is in turn deprived in the world of the mechanics. Nevertheless, the atomist account remains in antiquity the most consistent attempt, based on quantitative and materialist assumptions, to solve the problem wherefrom this paper started, namely, filling the gulf between physical objects and chromatic sensations. Okay. Thank you.